There are the private emails, the social media accounts, online bank accounts, even digital music libraries. What do you know about your digital property, your digital assets, as they're called? And what on earth will become of them once you die? It's a question we're asking here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. How can you make sure your loved ones can get into all of your accounts? At the same time, how do you protect your privacy? Simpson Garfinkel thinks about this a lot. His new book is The Computer Book, From the Abacus to Artificial Intelligence, 250 Milestones in the History of Computer Science. He is an adjunct professor of digital studies at George Mason University, and his recent piece in MIT Technology Review is called Six Things to Do with Your Data Before You Die. Simpson, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Well, how are we doing with our wills and the integration of all of the digital things we have in our lives?
Well, for most people in the United States, that's not an issue because they don't have wills, unfortunately, which is a problem, but they don't have to worry about the integration. It turns out that if you have digital artifacts, online accounts, if you have home accounts, if you have data on your phone or data on your computer, you really have to worry about or think about what's going to happen with that information after you die if you care about the people that you would leave behind. If you don't care about those people, then you don't need to make plans. But it's very similar to what you have to do for other things that you might leave behind, whether it might be family members or possessions or cash.
What is a digital estate? What makes up a digital estate?
Well, we're trying to figure that out. There's no legal definition right now. There aren't any laws that I'm aware of that really cover this. For me, my digital estate would include the data on my computers, which of course is all encrypted because I use full disk encryption. It would include data that's in my house on hard drives. Most of those are encrypted, but some of them aren't. Data on CD-ROMs and DVDs. But it also includes information I have in the cloud. So it includes information on Facebook, and I have lots of photographs on Facebook, and I have things that I've written on Facebook. I used to use a service called LiveJournal, so that account is still there, and some of the postings are public, some of them are friends only, some of them are private. I own that account, but what happens with the information on the account would actually depend on both practice, and it would depend upon their terms of service document, but it also depends upon the whims of how it might be enforced by a customer service rep who answers the phone. As I said, things aren't entirely clear in a lot of places. And to show how that's true, Google and Facebook have very different approaches for how they deal with the data of people who are deceased. Google allows you to set up an account recovery email or somebody who will get control of your account if you stop being active.
Mm-hmm.
And Facebook says if you die, nobody owns your data anymore. And if things are private, nobody is allowed to access them.
And that has repercussions as well for loved ones if they want to either look at some messages to try to find out some clues about someone's death or whether they simply want more privacy for the person who's deceased.
Precisely. Let's be clear. Under U.S. law, people who are deceased don't have a right to privacy. That goes with you. Facebook claims that those private messages are protecting the privacy of the other party of the message. But Facebook may also be protecting themselves. There's a case in Germany of a girl who died. She fell in front of a subway car, and it wasn't clear whether it was an accident or whether she was depressed or whether she was the victim of cyberbullying. Her parents tried to get access to her Facebook account, and it went through the German courts. And the parents were never able to get that access.
We're talking with Simpson Garfinkel. He is the author of the book, The Computer Book, From the Abacus to Artificial Intelligence, 250 Milestones in the History of Computer Science. We're talking to him about what happens to our data after we pass and how to ensure that it is going to people, to our kin, in the right way. You can join in the conversation with your questions, 800-642-1234. Are you thinking about your digital legacy? Do you have a plan? Do you have passwords in a safe place for a loved one? Have you made a plan? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Simpson, let's talk a little bit about encryption. It used to be that if someone left behind their laptop or even a smartphone after death, or a dumb phone either, surviving relatives could easily gain access to it. They could get into it. What has changed there?
So companies like Apple and Google have moved to device encryption so that if your device is stolen, the thief won't be able to have access to it. And that's especially important for businesses where a stolen device might compromise the privacy or the security of thousands of people. It's important for individuals if you're worried about somebody breaking into your house and they steal your computer, you don't want them to have access to all of your financial records because then they might try to steal those pieces of information. But the same technology that prevents a thief from accessing your device's data would also prevent a loved one from accessing it after you die unless they know how to get in. And that means that they need to have the password or they need to have some other mechanism for getting access to the data.
In your piece, you talked about writing down on paper your password, sealing it in an envelope, putting it in a safe place, and letting that person know where it is. Is that a good plan?
So the sealed envelope is a technique that goes back decades. Mm-hmm. And the advantage of it is that you can tell if somebody's opened the envelope because it's been ripped. So, you know, typically you sign across the envelope's back flap. And when I had a company in the 90s, we gave copies of our encryption keys to our attorney who kept it in their file. But a lot of people don't do that. It's not something that there's a lot of instructions to do.
Is it as simple as making sure they have access to passwords, or is it more complicated than that?
It's becoming more complicated because of the use of multi-factor authentication. So if you're protecting an online account with both a password and a second factor, and then you die, the people who need to get access to your account need both the password and that second factor. So that can be a problem if the second factor is tied to a phone number that gets disconnected, or if it's a physical token that you were carrying around with you when maybe you got hit by a car and it was destroyed, or if you are just lost and never turn up.
So you're saying as well that there you have this multiple ways to get in and passwords aren't the only way. What is a digital backdoor, very quickly here before we go to break?
So digital backdoor is the term that we use for some way of circumventing the protection mechanisms. And that could be a password that's in an envelope, or it could be another technique that would bypass the password.
We're talking with Simpson Garfinkel. He's author of The Computer Book. A loved one's family may lack clear directions to accessing digital assets of the deceased. Sometimes even getting access to these accounts could take a complicated legal process, like going through probate. We're talking about how to manage the future of your digital property once you die here on The Morning Show. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Do your next of kin know the passwords to your personal computer or smartphone? Do you plan on telling them? Let's talk about it. Call in or tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll get back to the conversation in a minute on the Ideas Network. Thank you. What happens to your email and social media after you die? Estate planning now means making a plan for how you manage your virtual legacy, like your Facebook account, your family's digital photo album, your personal email inbox, and a lot more. This may mean reading the terms and conditions of each site you deal with to find out what can be done with your online self after you pass. We're learning about this on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Simpson Garfinkel is author of the new book, The Computer Book. You can join in with your questions, your plan at 800-642-1234. Do you want next of kin to have access to your social media accounts? What about other things like email, personal photos, and your work correspondence? Do you think about how it should be handled? Call in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Simpson, another issue here is medical records. Our physicians keep track of our medical records. There are elaborate systems now in place for online medical records. So why do we need to duplicate this ourselves?
So that is an open question. I believe that you should keep copies of your medical records so that if you need to provide them to another physician, you can do that. My father keeps around a copy of his medical records on a USB drive with him so that if he has an accident, the rescue people can see his medical records. I found that many times it's easier for me to give medical records to another doctor than to make them get it from doctor to doctor. There's also issues where when you have children, it's very important for children to have the medical records for their biological parents because so many diseases have an inherited component. And it may be difficult to get medical records after someone has died. So recently we did this for a family member, my wife, and it was actually quite difficult to get all of her parents' medical records because they'd been dead for so long. And we weren't able to get them all.
So because she couldn't, what were some of the barriers there?
So things get lost. Hospitals merge. Hospitals go out of business. Some have records retention policies that might cause those old records to be destroyed. The best way to be sure that you have them is to have them, rather than to rely on other people to keep them. But of course, if you have them, then that means that you have a security burden. You have to be sure that you both maintain them, that you can find them, and that they can't be misused. Now, in the case of medical records, the misuse is usually about revealing them to people who you don't want that information revealed to.
Looking at how we keep our passwords today, it seems like we're continually asked to change a password. I changed one yesterday. What about password managers and those ways we can just kind of deposit all our passwords in one place like LastPass? What do you think of them?
So most security experts will recommend that both businesses and individuals have password managers. LastPass is one. 1Password is another one. Some of them are better than others, and it's important that you use one that's been vetted by security experts. And most of the magazines have now written articles about the more reliable password managers. Both LastPass and 1Password have the ability to do password delegation, where you can share passwords between multiple users and you can give another user access to a password. So my wife and I have a shared password manager, and then we actually have the family version. So all of our children have the ability to use that for managing passwords as well. And it's important with your password manager that you be able to back up all your passwords and store them somewhere else. But it's important that those passwords themselves be encrypted with a key, so that neither somebody who doesn't have your interests or even the password manager company itself can't get access to them.
So it sounds like a password manager type system would be a pretty efficient, clean way to keep your digital affairs pretty tidy after you die.
It is, provided that your loved ones know the master password that you use for the password manager. The 1Password system, which is the one that I use, has both a master password and then another password, and it encrypts your data with both of them. And that second password has to be explicitly moved from device to device. That's a way that it gets additional security, but it's also a barrier if when you need extraordinary access.
Looking at how we use two-factor authentication today with increased security, hard to say, how can we avoid giving out our phone numbers?
So you shouldn't. There are many people who are using an SMS message to a phone as their second factor. Uh-huh. And one of the problems with that is that it's easy for thieves to steal a phone number. They can pretend to be you and go into a store and use a fake ID or do it over the phone and actually have your phone number moved to another device. And this happened to a person named Lori Craner, who was the chief technology officer at the Federal Trade Commission, uh-huh. And she wrote a blog post about it. And just one day, her cell phone stopped working. So the best thing you can do is make sure that set phone numbers aren't used for fallback authentication and aren't used for your second factor. Now, what you can do is you can have an app that runs on your cell phone, and Google Authenticator is such an app. But then there's a secret that's on your phone, and it engages in a protocol with the remote website, but it's not that somebody sends you an SMS message and you can reset your password that way.
We're talking with Simpson Garfinkel, and he wrote the book, The Computer Book. We're talking about our digital assets, what to do with them, and how to get them in order before we die. Simpson, social media, what do we need to consider when it comes to giving access to our next of kin, if that's something we want to do in terms of our social media accounts?
Yeah, so the first thing is that before you give access to somebody else, either while you're alive or while you're dead, you need to be sure that you want them actually to have access to all that data. And in the article that we wrote in Technology Review magazine, one of the professors that I interviewed said that he had a friend who her husband had died, and she finally broke into his account, and she discovered things about him that she really didn't want to know. So in general, there's that old rule, if you don't want somebody to know something, don't put it on a computer. If you don't want people to see information that you've been hoarding, it's better not to hoard that information. But after that, then with social media, you should know that Facebook and Google have very different policies. And if you're using Google, it's good to have an account recovery email address. And they have a lot of instructions on how to set that up. And if you're using Facebook, you should be aware that what their terms are. You can specify a person who can manage the account after you die. But it's a good idea to make sure that Facebook isn't your only copy of anything, because as they have it currently constructed, your family, your estate will probably lose access to that information after you pass.
Simpson, if you could give us one thing we could do today to better manage our digital assets and prepare them for us, what would be that one thing we could do, a step in the right direction?
So I think everybody should use a password manager, and there are several good ones out there. And I think that everybody should be using two-factor. So although the digital death is a really important thing to focus on, many of the protections that will protect your family members will also help you lead a more secure, more safe life online. And those are things that we all can do.
The last piece of advice you have is interesting. Be careful what you wish for. What do you mean by that?
Well, as I said, that was the story of the woman who got access to her husband's files after he died, and she found material in the files that really disturbed her and permanently changed her opinion of her husband, which is unfortunate because he died, right? And it would be nice if she had been left with good feelings instead of these tinged feelings afterwards.
It starts to feel overwhelming when we look at our digital footprint and how much of ourselves is out there on the cloud, on social media accounts, online banking. Our digital footprint is growing bigger and bigger every day. Is there a way we can truly keep this in order? Is there a way to have a tidy digital legacy?
Yeah. So I recommend that people try to keep their online presence and their devices as simple as possible, rather than having like 10 or 20 accounts and trying to keep them all straight. Just have a very small number and protect it well and have it backed up offline, so that even if all of your accounts are compromised, you still have a copy of your data. It's so easy to back things up now. You can get a hard drive that plugs into a laptop for less than $100 that stores 4 terabytes of data, and just use that as a backup so that you don't have just one copy in either in the cloud or at home.
Simpson, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
It was a lot of fun. Thank you for having me.
Simpson Garfinkel is author of the book, The Computer Book, and we've been talking about our digital assets. He's an adjunct professor of digital studies at George Mason University. Coming up, we talked to Representative Mike Gallagher of the 8th Congressional District. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. President Trump says he's determined to build a border wall and will shut down the government unless Congress pays for it. He told Democratic leaders on Tuesday that he'll close part of the executive branch if he doesn't get $5 billion to build a wall on the southern border with Mexico. Republican Congressman Mike Gallagher has been watching this and writing about the power of the executive branch and the dysfunction he sees in Congress. He represents the 8th Congressional District, covering Marinette County, Green Bay, Appleton, and the surrounding area. He joins us on The Morning Show as part of a series of year-end check-ins we're hoping to do with Wisconsin's House representatives. Congressman Gallagher, welcome to the program.
It is great to be back. I appreciate it.
Well, let's start with the Farm Bill, which saw a lot of movement this week. Congress reached a compromise on the bill. The Senate passed the bill. House last night voted overwhelmingly to support it. This version does not include the stricter work requirements for food stamp recipients, which was in the bill you voted for in June. Why did you cast your vote yesterday against the 2019 Farm Bill?
I think there's a few things going on here. The first is, in Northeast Wisconsin and across the country, it is true that agricultural producers are suffering the worst farm economy in over a decade. We've seen real farm income decline by 52% in the last 5 years alone. But you have to ask why. At least in the dairy industry, it's a few things, or at least what I hear from farmers in Northeast Wisconsin. It's overproduction, it's an adverse trade environment, and then it's continued workforce challenges related to a lack of immigration reform. Unfortunately, this bill does nothing on all of those fronts. And indeed, I fear, having learned how Washington, D.C. works, it will allow legislators to claim victory while actually doing nothing to address the source of the problem. So there's a lot of things in the bill I support, and there's a lot that I fought to get in there, particularly on the conservation programs. Although we cut some conservation funding and certainly fixing the margin price protection program, overall, I fear it won't actually alleviate the concerns of farmers in Northeast Wisconsin. The second thing to say is that, as you alluded to, 80% of the bill is related to food stamps. So a very small portion actually deals with farming. And I think, as someone who's been writing about legislative dysfunction, this reflects how D.C. operates. You sort of cobble together unrelated provisions. You jam an 800 bill through a process at the last second, $867 billion of spending. And we don't consider actual meaningful reforms to these programs. I'm open to the idea that there's perhaps a better way to reform our food stamp program than work requirements, but it's clear to me that the program isn't doing what it's intended to help people get out of poverty. Consider the fact that at a time of very low unemployment, we have increased enrollment in these programs. So again, I'm open to a better way, but I just can't support dysfunctional process anymore in Washington, D.C.
But you voted against the bill, and producers here, they're up against the challenges you mentioned, trade, falling commodity prices, and their issues with a workforce. This farm bill does try to address some of these things by way of subsidies, billions of subsidies for the farmers. But you voted against the bill.
I don't think the bill will do anything to help on the trade issue. It's why I've introduced a separate bill to require the House to vote on any tariff imposed under Section 232, which is actually really hurting our farmers right now. That's why I've been encouraging the House also to stay in session until we get a comprehensive fix to our immigration problems. So if I did feel that on balance the bill would help or would have meaningful reforms, as opposed to just continuing the status quo, which I think even farmers would admit was suboptimal to them. And my Democratic colleague, Ron Kind, who also voted against the bill, has done a ton of work on identifying the fact that it is illegal under current law to even know where payments for crop subsidy is going. That seems absurd to me, and it suggests that most of the crop subsidy payments aren't actually helping out struggling dairy farmers, particularly on smaller dairy farms in Wisconsin, but they're going to large cotton producers in the southern part of the United States.
Well, let's move on to China and trade, the trade war. President Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping recently reached a three-month trade truce. What role does Congress have in these trade talks?
Congress should be demanding far more of a role in these trade talks, in any trade provision. If you look at the history of trade legislation over the last few decades, it's really been a history of Congress ceding its authority to regulate commerce with foreign nations under the Constitution to the executive branch. I think that's wrong. It works if you happen to agree with the policy of the executive branch, but there's a lot of times when you might not want to. And I think it's always wise to invest power where it's most accountable to the American people, and that happens to be in our legislature. So again, that's why I introduced that trade bill that I alluded to earlier. I think it makes no sense to put Wisconsin farmers in the middle of a trade war, especially at a time when milk prices are low and our farmers are struggling and family farms are shutting down. At the same time, I agree very much with the sentiment that the White House has expressed that we need to take action against the Chinese government's aggressive behavior. But the reality is what concerns us most about China is not tariffs, but rather their non-tariff barriers, things like the theft of intellectual property, what they demand in return for market access, forced technology transfer. So there's a lot to like in the Section 301 findings that the administration put forward in an effort to get tough against China. But I would disagree with also picking a fight simultaneously with the rest of the free world under Section 232, because that imperils our farmers. At the same time, one of the best things we can do to get tough on China, which will help us get tough economically and strengthen our diplomacy, is to continue rebuilding our military, which will make them think twice about coming after us economically. There's no doubt China is conducting economic warfare against us on a daily basis, and I think we need to be laser-focused in working with our allies to rally support against their destructive practices like cyber attacks, technology theft. And I hope we can focus our trade agenda and actually our efforts across the government on gathering up the free world to stand up against the Chinese Communist Party.
So you introduced bipartisan legislation that would direct the president to impose denial orders banning the export of U.S. parts and components to Chinese telecommunications companies that violate U.S. export control or sanctions laws. Can you break down this legislation for us? What you're trying to do here?
Yeah, so basically what we've seen, whether it's companies like Huawei or ZTE, multiple analyses across the government have shown what we've long known, which is that these companies are instruments of the Chinese Communist Party. And these companies pose serious counterintelligence concerns to us in the United States, and they're trying to gain market access in the United States. It's why in last year's National Defense Authorization Act, we did a complete overhaul of something called the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. And the idea was to give the government more tools to understand when Chinese companies that are instruments of the Chinese Communist Party are trying to gobble up American companies and thereby gain a foothold in our country and potentially jeopardize our secrets and further steal our intellectual property theft. So all this would do is give the government more tools to go after Chinese companies and disallow certain businesses in the United States, particularly those that do business with the Pentagon and are involved in sensitive technologies, from working with Huawei and ZTE and other companies that are instruments of the Chinese government.
Talking with Congressman Mike Gallagher, he's a Republican serving Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District. We're getting up to speed on legislation in Washington, a little year-end check-in. You can join in. You have a line, 800-642-1234. What do you want to ask the congressman? How do you want him to vote? Perhaps on immigration legislation, should more funding go toward a border wall? What do you want him to know about the latest farm bill? What about health care? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So going back to Huawei for a moment here, the chief financial officer for this Chinese tech company faces extradition to the U.S. over allegations they sold equipment to Iran, and that violates U.S. sanctions. Does that impact the way you view China in trade negotiations?
Well, it certainly confirms what I've long suspected and what I alluded to before, which is to say that Huawei is part and parcel of the Chinese Communist Party. I think it's going to make it harder in the short term for us to get a broader agreement with China on trade. I think there is room to talk about de-escalation, certainly when it comes to tit-for-tat tariffs. But I think we're at the beginning of a long-term struggle with China over what the future of the global economic order looks like. And certainly since at least 1945, the United States has been the leader in establishing the rules of that order, and it's one of an open economy and clear protection of the global commons. It's clear that China has a very different vision of the future, a future that it would dominate, a future in which it would dominate its own citizens and compromise their privacy, and it would seek to be the lone hegemon in the Indo-Pacific region. That presents a very real threat to our values. It presents a very real threat to our allies. And so I think we're at the beginning of what some have termed a new Cold War with China, and it's going to require new thinking, just as our entire national security establishment needed to be overhauled in the late 40s to deal with the rising threat from Soviet Russia. Now, I hope that we can resolve this peacefully. Great power conflict would be incredibly destructive for the world. But it's clear to me that the previous strategy, which is actually a bipartisan one, of seeking to integrate China into the global economy, thinking that doing so would moderate its behavior and that they would become what was termed a responsible stakeholder, that failed. That failed in spectacular fashion. And so the very fact that we're recognizing that we need to take a different approach, that great power competition with China is going to be the pacing threat for at least the next few decades, is an important one. Because if you look at what the Chinese Communist Party leaders have explicitly said, what they want the world to look like in 2050 is far different from what we want the world to look like in 2050.
Very quickly here, moving to the Oval Office, President Trump held a meeting with top Democrats Tuesday, very publicly, proud of a possible shutdown of the government over the border wall. Where do you stand on funding for the border wall versus other critical government operations?
Well, I do think we need to fund the border security, the border wall, border, whatever we're calling it today. Having worked on the southern border, it's clear to me that we do not have operational control of it. That's been confirmed by multiple administration officials across administrations. And so the question of how we do that is perhaps up for some debate. The president himself, I think, signaled a willingness to compromise, saying that depending on what sector of the border you're in, you may need different procedures. There's some parts of the border where literally you have sort of a canyon and a river going through it, where obviously you don't need to build a wall through the river. So it's clear to me that Congress, though, not only needs to consider border security, but a more comprehensive approach to our immigration system. Because the reality is most people coming in our country illegally are not coming through the southern border. They're simply overstaying their visas. And so internal enforcement has to be part of this as well. But we need to fix the system, right?
Well, let's pause right there, Congressman Mike Gallagher. Let's pause. He's a Republican serving Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District, representing Green Bay, Appleton, and the surrounding area. You have a line, 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation in a couple minutes here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us. Congressman Mike Gallagher is on the line as we check in with Wisconsin's congressional delegation at the end of the year. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, thanks for being with us. We're talking with him about pressing issues before Congress and his thoughts on partisan gridlock. You have a line at 800-642-1234. What legislative issues are forefront on your mind that you want to ask him about? You can call in. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. So getting back to this conversation about the shutdown, the deadline, December 21st, is looming, like 8 days away. President Trump wants $5 billion for the wall. Democratic leaders refusing more than maybe $1 billion and change for that border wall. Do you see room for compromise when the Democrats control your chamber?
I don't know, to be honest with you. What's weird to me is that we're going to vote on a few things today, and then we're going to leave. And I don't think we're in session on Monday and Tuesday. But so for all the talk about, oh, we're coming up against Christmas, well, we're basically taking 6 days off right now. That's absurd to me. I mean, we should be here debating this. And this actually shouldn't be negotiated between the president and Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. This should be going through the committee process in the House and the Senate, because that's where you can actually examine facts and have an open and honest debate in front of the American people about how much border security we need, what trade-offs we might be willing to make. And so I just bring that up to suggest that it sort of confirms my basic point about the House, which is until we fix the process, we're never going to get any improvement on the actual policy. And I fear that even if we solve this short-term funding issue, that the prospects for real comprehensive immigration reform are very dim over the next 2 years in divided government, and particularly with the vortex of the 2020 election risking sucking everything into its wake. And so I don't think it should be that way. I think we should fix the process. And, you know, I just want to be able to walk into the House chamber and have a debate on the merits about things like immigration and health care and other issues. I'm open to evidence and the idea that I'm wrong about things. But right now we're just sort of waiting to the last second, and that's not the best way to get any good outcome.
Well, we have people lined up here wishing to ask you some questions. Let's go to Steve in Waukesha first. Hi, Steve, go ahead.
Hi, my question is, for immigration reform, has anything been submitted to actually massively penalize the businesses that are keeping illegal immigrants employed? So go after the businesses that are employing the illegal immigrants. Make it harder for the illegal immigrants to get jobs and retain jobs if they're not in the country legally.
Steve, thanks for the question there. Representative, go ahead.
Well, you raise a really good point, which is to say, even if we had a wall or, you know, an AI-enabled surveillance technology that would allow us to know with 100% certainty who is and isn't coming across the southern border, until we have internal enforcement, we wouldn't have actually fixed the problem. So in the what's currently being discussed, the short-term crisis, no, nothing has been submitted. What's commonly suggested as part of this, and I do think needs to be part of any comprehensive reform, and we inch towards this in the comprehensive reform that we voted on a few months ago, is mandatory E-Verify, right? So that each company that's employing immigrant labor would have to go through the E-Verify process so they couldn't have illegal labor. Now, in order to do that without completely destroying our economy in Wisconsin, you'd also, in my opinion, have to have a state-based guest worker visa program that would allow farms, for example, to get the legal labor that they need to stay in business. In my opinion, and this may sound simplistic, I think most Americans, as a matter of principle, could get behind the idea that, one, we should make it difficult, if not impossible, for people to come here illegally. We should make it very easy and transparent and out in the open for people to come here legally. And we need a flexible system where we can scale up or scale down the amount of people that we want to let here legally, depending on the unique needs of our economy at a given time. And we always have to prioritize our own citizens and our own workers and take care of them first.
Well, Steve, thanks for the call. And very quickly, as we try to wrap up immigration, Mike, go ahead in Vilas County. We're running out of time on this conversation, but go ahead.
Thank you. My only question was, and I understand what he's saying, and I agree with what he's saying, but the actions are different. I mean, the GOP could have passed immigration reform, and I worked for a department that was in a regulatory role, and I would deal with these corporate farms, and when I would come there in uniform in my squad, all the workers would disappear, but all these big farms had their big GOP signs out supporting the GOP. So I think a lot of this stuff is just smoke and mirrors. I mean, there's a lot of farms that are benefiting financially, not the small local farms that should be, but some of these big corporate farms by having illegal immigrants.
Mike, thanks for the call. How do you weigh that, Congressman?
I think there's a lot of truth in what you said, and certainly having dealt with it up front and up close and personal, you'd know better than I, but I think it just points to this broader issue that the longer we leave this question unaddressed, the worse the problem gets, the more illegal immigrants we have, which makes getting an eventual solution all the harder. And so the longer we punt on it, I just think we get further away from a solution. And so you also raise the issue that indeed we did try as we controlled the House over the last 2 years, to pass comprehensive immigration reform. And part of that, as I mentioned before, would have made E-Verify mandatory. We came up short in our initial vote. We got about 193 votes. You generally need 218 votes to pass anything in the House. But at that point, we shouldn't have just given up. We should have gone back to the committee process and said, okay, what changes do we need to make in order to get to 218? No one gets 100% of what they want. I have been in Congress for 2 years now. I've never got to vote on a perfect bill, with the possible exception of a bill that I wrote and passed, which I thought was perfect. But you always got to be willing to make some compromises. And so always got to be looking to how do we get to 218? Because actually the worst possible outcome, I think, is what we're doing right now, which is to say nothing. Or we're going to have a CR and just continue the status quo that everyone seems to recognize is absurd and actually hurts people. I mean, we've seen terrible images of people trafficked across the border in trucks or dying in the back of trucks, or it's just absolutely heartbreaking, the current situation. And so I'm willing to step up, and we should stay in session until we can fix this problem.
Representative Gallagher, I want to quickly here go to health care. And you saw this lame duck session that just happened here in Wisconsin. During that session, state lawmakers passed legislation that makes it harder for the governor-elect of Wisconsin and incoming Attorney General Josh Call to pull Wisconsin out of the multi-state lawsuit against the Affordable Care Act. Last year, you voted to repeal and replace Obamacare. What do you do right now to improve health care here in Wisconsin and in America?
I think the most obvious starting point, recognizing that health care is a very contentious issue and people on both sides have demagogued the issue, is to, in an area where I think everyone can agree right now, is on radical price transparency. I think the fundamental problem in health care is that we as patients cannot decipher our health care bills. We have no idea what the heck we're paying for when we engage in the healthcare system. And until we can bring some transparency to that process, we are never going to have the power. And the reality is that the complexity, the opacity, benefits big hospitals, it benefits insurance companies, and it keeps all the power concentrated at the top. And so I have a bipartisan bill with a Democrat, if you can believe it, from Colorado on price transparency. I think it's a meaningful step forward. It's by no means sufficient. The issue of drug price transparency is also coming to the fore. And even in divided government at a time when healthcare is a very difficult issue, I think that's one area that both sides can agree upon, and we should look for what's a constructive step we can take forward as opposed to just hammering each other on the issue of healthcare. And so that's where I'm going to be focusing a lot of my efforts. And the other thing I think we need to talk about, we don't talk about enough, is the fact that the question of how you finance health insurance is actually not the most important question, because it's not the most important to your health. How can we create, I was listening to your lead up, and yet again, Wisconsin leads the nation in binge drinking, right? So that's very unhealthy for our communities. We need to think about how can we repurpose funds and programs to get upstream of health insurance, right? How can we build healthier communities, get people more active? And that's an interesting question. And there's some data at the local level. I had one thing suggested to me to tie this to the farm bill by a local health official in my district. I said, okay, if you were king for a day, how would you solve this mess? And he said something, I thought he was joking at the time, and I now come to believe there's truth. He said, I would take all the subsidies that we pay to the sugar industry in the farm bill, and I would repurpose those towards preventive community health care grants. I think there's some truth to that.
And I want to pause you right there with that anecdote. As we wrap up here, what is your New Year's resolution for Congress?
Oh, a simple one. Change the schedule. Keep us in session so we actually work a full week. We're only going to work about 120 days. It's actually less if you look at the full days next year. In what other industry would you get paid for only working 120 days a year? Wouldn't require changing law. Just change the calendar and force us to do our darn jobs.
Thank you for joining us, Congressman. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
U.S. Congressman Mike Gallagher is a Republican serving Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District that covers Green Bay, Appleton, and the surrounding area. You heard him here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us.